Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I'm a TV critic for such publications as the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and the New York Observer, at several of which I cover Game of Thrones. I am the co-author of the official annotated Game of Thrones with series editor Ann Grohl and Elia Garcia Jr. from Westeros.org and the World of Ice and Fire. And I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones weblog that covers a lot of other things too, located at BoiledLeather.com, which is where this podcast is hosted. And with me as always, speaking of hosting, my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. So today we present to you our third and final installment of our prediction series for The Winds of Winter. And in related news, it seems like it won't come out in 2016, which just ends a dismal year in just the right fashion. So fingers crossed for 2017 there. But we will finish our predictions. And just as a refresher for you, because it's been some time, in our first episode, we covered all the point of view characters that are currently located in the North general area, North, which means Bran, Davos, Melisandre, Asha, Theon, Jon Snow, and a host of supporting characters like Rickon, Asha, Hodor, Tormund Giantsman, Wyman Manderly, the Reeds and the Boltons. We talked about what will happen to Hardhome, Winterfell and the Wall, and so on and so forth. So if you don't remember anything, please, by all means, recheck the episode. And we also did a second part of it, which covered everything that was going on in Essos, which concerned itself with Arya, Barristan, Victarion, Tyrion, and Daenerys, and supporting characters like Jorah Mormont, Mokaro, Marvin the Mage, and the Dragons. So what is left for us today is basically the center of Westeros, for lack of a better word, so the King's Landing region and the Riverlands, and of course the south, so Dorne and the Reach, where we don't exactly have a plethora of point of view characters. So this might be a little bit shorter and heavier on speculation than other stuff.
Before we go into the characters from this portion of the world of Ice and Fire, one of the things that has changed, or several things have changed since the last time we recorded these episodes, which was a while ago, I think there were episodes 45 and 46, so they were much earlier in 2016. But since then, we had two more preview chapters, another Arianne, which we had already gotten in dribs and drabs. There's a little bit of overlap, or there was at some point, with the previous Arianne sample chapter, and he'd read it at events, so the information was out there. And then there was that crazy Aeron Dampyr chapter, where he's chained up in Euron's the hold of his ship with all these other priest characters. So those things kind of shaped what we know about the Winds of Winter, obviously, and contradicted some of the predictions, I'm sure, that we made. And then the other thing is that Game of Thrones Season 6 aired, and I still insist that you can't say that if just because something happened on Game of Thrones, that's dispositive as to what's going to happen in A Song of Ice and Fire. But certainly some of it is. We know for a fact that the Hodor thing has been confirmed, for example, by George. So that changes the landscape under our feet somewhat considerably in terms of the predictions and just our general idea of what the Winds of Winter will be like. Now, I don't know that I'll necessarily be citing either of them all that much, either the sample chapters or Game of Thrones. Like, I have no idea if Cersei's going to blow up the Great Sept with everybody in it. It was cool for the show. I don't know what it means. But anyway, it's just something to think about. You know, if you do go back, like Stefan suggested, and re-listen to the previous preview chapters and we're way off base, just keep in mind that we were doing this before a lot of information came out. And also, we're just doing this for fun. We're not married to any of these things. So that's my basic take on it.
So, with all of that being said, the first character we want to tackle is, of course, the beautiful maiden in the castle, which is Sansa. And Sansa has, as many characters by now, had her own preview chapter published by George. That was in 2015, so it's been quite a while. And the obligatory spoiler warning here for you, we will talk about the preview chapter as well. And for those of you who haven't read it or haven't read it in quite a while, a very short recap of it. We get a political and economic part in where we see what Peter Baelish is up to, because he is hoarding food with the intent to sell it to the rest of Westeros once the supply dries up in the winter and in all the wars that are to come. We get the information about the goddamn tapestries that he wanted out of King's Landing. And the main part of the chapter is reserved for a big event that Sansa organized, which is a tourney for the Knights of the Vale, in which they can qualify for a place in a new order, a knightly order, which she made up, the Knights of the... something with wings. I don't remember the actual name. Winged Knights or something. And she did this in order to tie them to the Lord Protector's regime and Robert Arryn and all that kind of stuff. And it's full of romanticism. And Peter Baelish uses this to introduce her to Harry the Heir, which she meets and who is an arrogant prick because she's still in her Elaine guise. He doesn't really know her, and she spins him around her little finger and manipulates him like an ace. And we also meet Shedrick the Mouse again, whom Brienne has met on the road. And it seems like he tries to abduct Sansa, but before anything can happen with it, the chapter ends. So that is very basically the recap. And to take it from there, we have to try and make a prophecy of our own. What will happen with Sansa's arc? So will Sir Shedrick be successful? And what are the Knights of the Vale up to, and how will her reveal go over with Harry the Heir?
You tell me, man.
Okay, so here comes my personal pet theory load. I think Sir Shedrick will not be successful, so he will not abduct her, but he will try, and his attempt will be foiled, and that will basically force everyone's hand in revealing the secret about Sansa. Either he does it himself, or they will preemptively do it, and then they will go on with the wedding just as planned, you know, like a plan that really works just as Peter Baelish has imagined it, and the Knights of the Vale will be just swept away from the emotion and the knightly values on display, and then Sansa will take the reins and basically ask them to secure her birthright, just like it was planned, and they will go north, and everything will go downhill from there, basically. Because they will arrive, as in the show, but not for some final battle or something. It will most likely already be over. But they will arrive in time to support the war against the others, which will be very interesting. So, and I guess the Knights of the Vale and Peter Baelish will die. I don't know if in the Winds of Winter or in A Dream of Spring, but they will never leave the North again. So this is my very basic take, very, very basic, on how the Sansa plot will play out. But many questions are still unanswered. So, for example, will Sandor Clegane rejoin her? Will she meet Arya again? All that kind of stuff is still much up in the air in my rough outline. So feel free to fill any gaps or criticize my vision.
I think it's pretty solid. I'll admit that it took me some time just to readjust my brain to the fact that she's in the Vale and not in Winterfell, you know, after a year of thinking of her show version. I had completely forgotten the preview chapter, so it took some rebooting on the part of my brain. My one quibble with it is that I feel that Littlefinger has to get back to King's Landing at some time, because he has to be within striking distance of the Iron Throne before he finally gets his comeuppance. That's my gut feeling. That's been my gut feeling for the longest time. I think probably one of the earliest things that I thought about the direction the books would go, and this was before Dance came out and before the show, is that Littlefinger will have everything that he ever wanted just within reach, and then all of a sudden, oh shit, it's a legion of snow zombies and they're demon people bosses, and it'll all fall apart because it's the one variable he didn't account for. So that's my thinking, because I don't see him participating in a war against the others at any rate. I don't think he has anything of value to contribute. Personally, I think it would be a completely different mindset than what he's able to adopt. You know, this is not a selfless person by any stretch of the imagination.
Absolutely not.
And not even to the extent that Davos was able to convince Stannis that in order to win the throne, he had to win over the realm instead of the other way around. And so Stannis went and fought the wildlings at the wall. I don't even think he has... Littlefinger doesn't even have that level of self-sacrifice in him. So I don't see him... I don't see him being present in the north for the initial wave of fighting against the others, both because I think he's got to wind up dying in the south, and because what good does he do there? And I don't think he's equipped for it as a character.
I can see your point, definitely. The problem that I see a little bit is logistics, because while Martin certainly isn't very exact when it comes to distances and travel times, he's not quite as cavalier as the show, with teleporting back and forth. So Littlefinger has to be like in the initial landing in the north, because he has to secure his grip on Sansa and this new political marriage and everything. He can't just leave them alone, I think. And this makes the logistics of it really difficult. And we will come back to this again later in the podcast when we talk about King's Landing, or the King's Landing Knot, for lack of a better word. Mm-hmm. But many characters will converge there as well. And if you send Littlefinger back into the mix, I'm not quite sure how he reaches his objective there. If he is physically in the presence of the Iron Throne. Because the person who will be there just in striking distance and see it all fall apart in King's Landing is his polar opposite, Varys. When Aegon has taken the throne and the perfect prince seems to play out as it should, and then Dany comes and burns the whole thing down. That seems to me like there is enough drama going on with Varys, and I don't know how you would logistically get a plot in where Petar Baelish also gets into striking distance of his goal, especially since it's the polar opposite and mutually exclusive with Varys' goal. That's a little bit of the logistical conundrum I see. He is absolutely not equipped to be in the north, which may be just why he's there in a miserable state. You know, he can see it from front row seat, how it all unravels, and be a first-hand witness just how wrong he was all his life in his priorities. You know, when the wall falls and an army of ice zombies sweeps down, and he just has to realize that he basically wasted his entire life with the wrong stuff. I think this works much more forcefully if he is really there and really sees it, rather than getting a dispatch while being in King's Landing.
That's a good point. Yes, that's a good point too. Because he would have received word, were he in King's Landing during the assault of the others as they start marching south, obviously he would receive word that that was happening beforehand. So it can't be like a surprise attack on King's Landing that suddenly all of his plans go up in smoke. So that's, you may have persuaded me. You may have persuaded me right there. The other question is, does Martin want to knock Littlefinger off the board in Book 6 and clear room for other people in Book 7? I was just going to say that obviously would factor into when and where Littlefinger's downfall takes place.
I think the where is Winterfell, and the win is pretty much in the beginning of book 7 in A Dream of Spring, because it is still my headcanon, and I think I've said as much in our first prediction podcast, that the wall will come down either in the epilogue of The Winds of Winter or in the prologue of A Dream of Spring. So since he needs to witness these events in some capacity, I guess in the first quarter or third of A Dream of Spring, he definitely has to go. After that, I don't see room for him. As you just said, he needs to be out of the way. This is this big vacuum cleaning process that Martin hasn't really started yet in the books, which the show has already kicked into high gear. You know, characters going down left and right and really condensing the narrative on a few main characters again.
Right, right.
This will have to happen in the books as well. But I think Littlefinger will be one of those guys who goes down in the beginning of A Dream of Spring just to underline the danger and importance of the White Walkers. Perhaps he even survives the whole thing, but will be mentally broken and totally disempowered or whatever. But I think he will die.
It's fascinating to talk about these things because so much of it is, at least the way you and I approach these things, is really impressionistic. It's almost like when I write comics, like when I write a script for a comic, it's all about pacing and it's all about what you put in each panel on each page, and you kind of just get a sense of this scene needs to be a little bit longer, this image needs to take place in panel 9 and not panel 8 and not panel 4. It's intuitive. But you just develop a sense of like how the story is supposed to flow. And I find that as we're talking about Littlefinger here, that's what I'm thinking, much more than any kind of strictly narrative-based or logistical concerns. Narrative meaning plot. I'm thinking, when does it feel right for a character as important as Littlefinger to no longer factor into the story? When does it feel right for him to find out that it was all for naught? Where does it feel right for that to take place? It's a gut feeling, like I said earlier. That's interesting. I don't know that I've ever really thought about it in quite that way before. But it's also almost like music. Like you just know, like this is the part of the song where this kind of thing should happen, you know? And we're trying to find out, like, when is the big climactic guitar riff for Littlefinger happen? And I'm not sure. I can see why you might want to eliminate him in book 6, so that book 7 is, we're not dealing with the political machinations anymore. It's straight up epic fantasy. But at the same time, he's such an important character that I can see saving his demise until book 7 for that reason alone. So
if I would need to construct a pacing here for whatever reason, really, I would definitely put it in book 6. But as I said, in the first third or at the maximum half, because what I would want to do pacing and thematic wise is to use a character as important as Littlefinger and as associated with the titular Game of Thrones to really underscore how that plot line ends.
Yes,
you know,
sure.
And dies off.
Right.
And I think if you do this in book 6, it's too early. A complete book about the high fantasy stuff seems too much, because then you wouldn't have the reckoning of all those political players with the physical metaphysical plot, and you need to have that. But you can't draw it out too long. I mean, it will all be this big oops in so many variations. But Littlefinger is one of our prime shakers and movers, and he needs to get his comeuppance in this way.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
And of course, there also needs to be a reckoning, or perhaps there needs to be a reckoning with Sansa. I mean, will she ever find out what Littlefinger really did? I'm not quite sure, to be honest. I mean, in earlier times, I always thought, yeah, of course. I mean, she needs to find out, and then she needs to kill him. You know, the pupil who exceeds the master, and then she gets him at his own game and all that kind of stuff. But that contradicts what we just said. So these are two conflicting visions for how Littlefinger's story plays out.
Right. That's a compelling question, and it's one that I thought of while watching season 6 of the show, because in the end, Littlefinger has basically, you know, broken away from the Iron Throne completely, and now Starks are back in charge of Winterfell. Meanwhile, Cersei's in charge of King's Landing, and she hates them. So what better way for Cersei to sow discord in the court at Winterfell than to send a raven and be like, oh, by the way, you know who narked on your dad? It was Littlefinger. I don't know what's stopping her besides the fact that she's nuts, and maybe she will do it, but that's the problem with the question of, will Sansa find out what Littlefinger did? Who's going to fucking tell her? There has to be a compelling reason for Cersei to make that knowledge available to her.
In the show, yes, but in the books, it becomes more complicated.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Okay,
now I get your point. Yeah,
right.
That might be if Cersei is in power long enough, which I don't think she will be. But again, we come to that in the King's Landing plot. Yeah. I don't really see her really giving a rat's ass about what happens in the North in the Winds of Winter. So I don't see her in a position to influence anything in A Dream of Spring. Well, so if Sansa finds out, and if this should be a plot point, it seems to me like this should be more of either a mistake by Littlefinger, you know, him essentially misjudging the whole situation, like when he thinks that revealing this by himself gets him anything, or Sansa, because of her new jobs, finds it out somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that is all premised on the idea that this will be the direction in which it goes, which contradicts death by walkers. A little bit, at least.
Yeah.
So I don't see exactly yet how this will go, and I'm genuinely unsure. There are possibilities to combine these two approaches, you know, like Sansa exiling him and then he's outside of Winterfell and the others come or whatever. That could all happen.
I love that. Mm-mm-mm. Yeah, that's delicious poetic justice right there.
Yes, somehow, yes. But it could also very well be that Sansa will never learn, or will only learn basically after all is over. Like, Littlefinger was even worse than you thought.
Right. And she doesn't necessarily need to learn that. She has ample evidence that Littlefinger is a piece of shit. She doesn't know about this fundamental betrayal that set all of this stuff in motion for her life, but she doesn't really need to. And it might be interesting for her to come to these conclusions on her own, based solely on what she has witnessed him doing, rather than have this sort of smoking gun handed to her about Littlefinger's involvement with her father's imprisonment and death. I also assume, this may be a digression, what do we think? Do we think Littlefinger is the person who put the bug in Joffrey's ear to have Ned executed?
Absolutely.
Yes, right, okay, yeah, so. But that may be the interesting thing. If you're doing a sort of the education of Sansa Stark storyline, it would be interesting if she came to the conclusion that he was a garbage person who needed to go without having that straight up confirmation of that suspicion in, you know, at hand.
I would honestly like it, because there should be room beside all those personal stories for some structural issues to be resolved as well. And Littlefinger personifies so much that's wrong about the Game of Thrones and its implications for the people and all that kind of stuff. If you pull this on the whole personal, you killed my father level, you know, you are basically repeating the George Lucas mistake of making it all about the Skywalkers in episodes 1-3.
Yeah.
And yes, that was a really bad way to introduce our next topic. But anyway, this is, just now, I would want it more in the sense that you just said, you know, she comes to the conclusion that he is a piece of garbage, that he needs to be removed from the scene. However you do it, and, you know, not even kill him or anything because he's not worth that. And it's not necessary given the invasion that is to come. So I guess that's how it will go.
Yeah. This is probably an appropriate time to say that where the remaining Stark children are concerned, I'm pretty much an optimist about their character, like, by moral character, I mean, their moral fiber. I don't really see any of them turning permanently to the dark side, even in the kind of shades of gray anti-hero kind of way. I think that they'll, even Arya will be able to rebound from the violent lifestyle that she has sort of been forced by circumstance to adopt. I don't think Sansa's going to stab any of her brothers in the back. I don't think any of them are going to marginalize her. I this is just maybe purely wish fulfillment or you know, just a wish on my part, but I see the Stark kids to the extent that they meet up or join forces or are aware of each other at any point in the future, all pretty much getting along. Maybe that's boring, but that's just kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree.
Yeah.
So let's go to the sibling that definitely doesn't get along, which is Cersei, who currently is in a very tight spot in King's Landing, you know, having just finished her walk of shame. And I was just really tempted to say is ruling in King's Landing, but again, that's the show. So let's erase the show out of our heads for this one. Cersei is still in the arms of Sir Robert Strong, awaiting her trial. So how do you think this will turn out?
Well, not well for anybody, really. The question, I think, is just how bad does it get before some figure, perhaps Aegon, who's fake, by the way, comes in to present some sort of alternative. Because the other major thing that happened at the end of the book is the Walk of Shame, and there's Sir Robert Strong, and there's the fact that in that scene where she's playing nice, like, she's obviously bullshitting. Like,
yeah,
she's clearly furious and just dying to kill everybody. And then Varys and his little birds come along and murk Kevin Lannister, who was actually doing a good job, and they murder him because he was doing a good job. So at that point, I think almost anything goes. I think Cersei will be paranoid, even though she didn't like him. She'll forget about that, to the extent that it gives her another excuse to be angry at the Tyrells, or at Tyrion and the Tyrells, or whoever she winds up blaming for his death. You have the High Sparrows there still. There's a Tyrell army. There's Lannister forces. I really think there could be chaos in the streets. And I thought that about season 6, too. They wound up going a different route with it. The Tyrells effectively were encouraged to retreat by Margaery, who was hoping she could get out of the trial on her own. And then in one fell swoop, Cersei wiped out the Tyrell leaders and the High Sparrow and most of the Faith Militant. So you avoided some of that. But I can see real, just nasty, almost house-to-house fighting between these factions. And I think Cersei will be kind of perfectly happy with that as long as scores are getting settled.
Yeah,
I don't like the odds for Tommen either. My assumption for the longest time has been that in some kind of trial by combat, like Sir Robert Strong will accidentally kill him. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Tommen has to die. There's a prophecy hanging over his head. The same is true for Myrcella.
Yep.
So they're dead meat. And even Cersei will be killed by the Voluncar.
Yeah.
So,
but that, I think, that's a Book 7 situation.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So, but let's talk more about the immediate aftermath of the Walk of Shame. The trial is upcoming, and I guess it will happen fairly early in The Winds of Winter. And we will have a clear win by Cersei. I don't believe in any of the elaborate theories who the champion of the faith will be. It will just be some knight, and he will be brutally slaughtered by Angregor. And then this is basically over. And I guess that Cersei will send Angregor after Margaery, so that she will be a victim of this huge zombie knight, which you can't really mix up with anyone else. So there is no plausible deniability at all. But at the same time, the Tyrell army is at Storm's End. It is marching back currently, yes, but still it is basically on the move, and so in the worst possible spot that it can be. It is led by Mace Tyrell, and his right-hand man, of course, is the utterly unreliable Tarly, Lord Tarly, who I guess will throw his lot in with John Connington, but again, yeah. We'll come to that later. So I don't think the Tyrell army will be of any use. So there is actually like a small Lannister majority in the city when it comes to troops, because the situation for a lot of Storm of Swords and Feast of Crows has been that the Tyrells are just so much more stronger than the Lannisters, so Cersei couldn't really do anything, but now she can. So your fighting in the streets scenario may very well come to pass, and given that the Queen of Thorns isn't even in the city, but I think also en route, there is quite the opportunity for a complete wipeout of everything Tyrell that is in the city. So this should happen. And then Cersei is in a position she needs to be for the story to progress, which is being queen, to then get supplanted by a younger and more beautiful queen.
Yep.
So this is actually incredibly important. And I think this is also more or less her story arc in The Winds of Winter. She will be deposed by this younger, more beautiful queen, which I think is Arianne. And then she will survive it and flee to Castle Rock, where she will await her final fate for the Dream of Spring. Does this make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, I kind of assumed that Dany is the younger, more beautiful queen. I've always assumed that. I never really gave it much thought that it was going to be anybody else. I think it may still go that way. You think she makes it back to Castle? They had to go to Castle Rock for some reason or other. And that's as good. That is literally the best possible reason, is for Jaime to murder Cersei in Castle Rock. So maybe you're right about that.
Yeah, it definitely. I mean, it has to be Jaime who kills her, and so she has to survive being supplanted by the younger and beautiful queen. And yes, I also for a very long time assumed it had to be Dany. You know, she's the obvious candidate for a younger and beautiful queen. But Arianne also makes a host of sense, because she is also obviously younger and more beautiful, and she is actually in a position to supplant Cersei in a meaningful way, because we are in agreement that Dany's story of ruling is over right now, and that she is moving into a more warrior prophet metaphysical plot element. So for this being dethroned to feel a little bit more personal and meaningful than the force of nature that Daenerys would represent, it has to be Arianne. You know, because if the one who deposes Cersei is Dany with her dragons, it is just like a natural catastrophe that sweeps her away. And this is, and all of her planning in A Feast for Crows is doubly useless, not only because it didn't help, you know, all the obsessing about the prophecy, which of course has to happen, you know, it has to be for naught. But if it is Dany and her dragons, it's doubly for naught, because Cersei wouldn't have any chance to do it right. And Cersei does anything in her power to prevent Margaery from supplanting her, and she succeeds. And then it's Arianne. So another political player with another political marriage in a last hurrah of the political plot, much like Littlefinger in the North. So we again have this mirroring of of last appearances of plot elements before we go into the magic-filled high fantasy finale. Mm-hmm. This makes much more sense to me, again, from a pacing and narrative viewpoint than Dany coming in and sitting the Iron Throne for some obligatory weeks before flying her dragons against whatever.
That stands to reason. I can support that, sure.
That's really boring.
I'm sorry, but
fight me on it.
You've persuaded me. What can I say? I don't know if you've 100% persuaded me. I just think Dany supplanting Cersei in to fulfill that prophecy has so much more kick than Arianne. I admit Arianne's never been one of my favorite characters, but I think even if you were talking about Margaery or Sansa or any other potential noblewoman, it just makes it's kind of like Littlefinger. Like, this is the thing Cersei never planned for. Cersei, of course, had her eye on Margaery, and she had her eye on, you know, any young, beautiful noblewoman within striking distance. So for all of a sudden the queen of the prophecy to come roaring out of the east on a dragon, I think would really knock her on her ass in a very narratively satisfying way. The same way that getting killed by Jaime instead of by Tyrion. I mean, she won't have long to be surprised by it, but that'll be a nasty little surprise. So that's my thinking there.
Okay. I mean, Dany's job seems more like what has been prophesized in A Clash of Kings, you know, Slayer of Lies.
Yeah.
And that is more Aegon, the wrong Aegon, which you have correctly said is not the real deal.
And who's the third? It's Stannis, Aegon, and what is the third lie?
Oh man, we had
gray, the gray corpse smiling sadly on the boat, right?
Yeah, it has to be Euron.
Or is that the husband? No, it's the stone beast breathing shadow fire. That's the
We had the discussion in the Supreme Court,
right?
There was a discussion whether it was John Connington because it's a griffin and he's stony right now.
Yeah,
but. Why? I mean, John Connington is already covered with Aegon. So it seems more like this is Euron and perhaps the dragon he conquers or whatever. Or maybe it's totally a red herring. I really have no clue regarding the House of the Undying prophecies. I'm so bad at this.
That's my shit, extremely. But I'm a little bit at a loss for that one. It'll be exciting to figure it out when that happens. I'll be like, ooh, yes, that's what that is. That'll be fun.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm really bad at predicting it.
Yeah.
You know, like going through all the evidence and looking at it, there are so many people who are much better at this stuff than I am.
I hear you. So I guess that leads us naturally to the forces.
Arianne.
And then also John Connington and you know, in terms of supporting players. Because we're kind of, for you all listening at home, we're working off a list of POV characters. But certain other characters who are prominent naturally come in when we discuss them. So Arianne, we have a great deal of information about her immediate future, thanks to the multiple sample chapters that have been released, and it's all fairly straightforward. She's roaming around with her little posse of Dornish people, trying to get a handle on what's up with Aegon and John Connington, and I think everybody assumes that she's going to, despite having turned over a new leaf and not being like this impetuous, angry conspiracist, she will wind up marrying the dude without her father's permission, thinking that this is turning over a new leaf, that this is the smart play rather than the reckless play. And I think she'll be right up until the point where she's wrong. And it winds up being a terrible idea.
Yeah, you know, I think she would actually have Doran's blessing. I mean, when he sends her up north, he gives her very explicitly the leeway to do just that. And given what he thinks, what the plan is, I think he's very much on board with it. Because you have to remember at the same time, he will receive word in the Winds of Winter from Garrys Dreamwater and just who is left also, I don't know. Quentin's two companions, they will give him word what happened, you know, like Daenerys murdered Quentin and she laughed about him before. So he will be anti-Daenerys.
Good point.
So, and since he is anti-Lannister also, throwing his support behind Aegon is the only way he could go. So he owns this. I don't think that Arianne is blundering in a direction that also clever Dornish Prince Doran Martell. Now I just lost the name there. That's weird. That he would have avoided somehow. I mean, Doran Martell is not an uber conspirator. He is not a mastermind. He has giant flaws, and his whole plan is coming crashing down for pretty much the whole of Feastlands. And this will only continue in The Winds of Winter, because we have all that stuff about, you know, the water gardens and the children there who should not suffer. And I mean, these are Chekhov's children. Of course, the children will suffer. Of course, the water gardens will burn. This has to end badly for this whole arc to play out correctly. So Arianne will marry Aegon and they will depose Cersei in ruling King's Landing, because else the slaying of lies doesn't carry any punch.
Good point.
So this has to happen.
And also
Arianne will die. We talked about this in our podcast about her sample chapters. I mean, the foreshadowing is everything but subtle in that cave with the echo, die, 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 you know. Mm-hmm. She's pretty much dead meat. And if she is, so is Aegon and John Connington.
Yes, I agree. One thing I wanted to interject about Sunspear, famously unburned, during Dorne's various wars with the Targaryens. There's the Dornish letter. There's all kinds of mysteries there. I feel like those were probably introduced in The World of Ice and Fire for a payoff in the novels themselves. So I think, you know, you mentioned Chekhov's children. I think you've got Chekhov's Dornish capital also. And some bad shit has to go down there.
Absolutely.
You know,
I mean, right. All that has to be figured out here is the logistics of it. I think this is the plot line where I'm most confident about predicting what will happen, and in predicting that this will either end in The Winds of Winter or very early in A Dream of Spring. That depends a little bit whether The Winds of Winter wants to close with Dany blowing up King's Landing or Dany arriving in the vicinity, you know, like an epilogue on a Dragonstone or something. This has to happen. You have to have the alliance between Aegon and the Faith. You have to have the alliance between Aegon and Dorne and the defeat of the Tyrell army. Because it has to be taken out of the picture in order for Euron's invasion to carry any water and to
no
emphasize the and to emphasize the threat for the South. I mean, if you keep the Tyrell army alive and intact, you really can't do this. This army needs to go,
and so
all of this has to happen. And Brendan Blackfish, the author or main author of the Wars of Ice and Fire blog, he has a pretty elaborate theory about how it will happen. You know, the military part of it, how it will play out, and he goes basically in the direction of a recreation of Essencourt, because Martin has talked extensively about this battle, and we haven't seen it so far. And this would be the prime moment to recreate it with all the military details we've got. So you have to check out this post if you're into the military stuff. I don't really want to get into so much detail, but the idea is that Randall Tarly will turn cloak, will deceive Mace Tyrell, join forces with Aegon, and then utterly defeat the Tyrell loyalists. And then the route is clear to King's Landing, and I guess Cersei will simply flee or something. But this should be how this plays out. And then the one big mystery left is what happens with John Connington, because right now he has discovered that he has this sickness. So will he spread it? Will he be patient zero for a for an epidemic in the Stormlands, or do you think this will be more on the level of a personal tragedy for him?
I think he's patient zero. I think that was just way too much of a big deal made of Grayscale in the last couple of volumes for it not to become a huge explosive problem. And it makes sense too, because the others can only cover so much ground, you know? Even if they just steamroll everybody, which is difficult to conceive of given the importance of the characters who are further north, it's still going to take them just a certain amount of time to get any place. So it would be helpful while they're marching through the north for the south not to just be sitting around like holding their breath and getting ready, but for the south to be a complete disaster. And Grayscale gets you there. And Grayscale gets you there with some sort of resonance with the zombie aspects of the others, you know, the frozen aspects of the others. Like, they kind of go together in a way.
It rhymes, yeah.
Yeah, yes, it rhymes, right. Before we move on, you brought up Aaron, and maybe that's where we should go next, but there's a couple of characters that I wanted to mention. Ariohota, for God knows what reason, is a POV character. So, how do you think, what do you think happens to old Ario?
I mean, right now he has been sent on this mission to obtain the Dark Star. And there are several ways you can go from here, because Ariohota is basically a walking window into wherever we need to look right now, whether it's Doran's deliberations or the feast with Balin Swan, or now the search for the Darkstar. He will have to face off against Balin Swan, and I guess he will kill him, because there has been made so much of a deal about the qualities of Ariohota, and until now we haven't really seen him against a real enemy. Mm-hmm. So I guess you will kill him. And then the question is if Obara either just escapes or whether she murders him, which might both be possible. And I guess Obara, who is also on this mission, will then go on to Old Town, because she wants to sack Old Town. She has mentioned this so often in A Feast for Crows, that she hates the city and that she wants to attack it and sack it. And if you look at on a map where Starfall is, this is just too tempting a possibility. So either she kills Ariohota, or he will prove to be a window a little bit longer when he goes behind her or whatever. But I think she will kill him, so he won't survive
the
winds of winter.
Now, where is Myrcella, and what's going to happen to Myrcella?
Oh, God. Myrcella will just die in one of these many events. You know, like, I would guess she's killed in King's Landing by, what's the name of the Sand Snake with the Septa's robes? Is it Tyeen? Doran has sent one of the Sand Snakes into the Council in his stead, and she's the one with the poisons, and I guess she will kill Myrcella.
Where is Myrcella currently? I can't remember.
They are bringing her up to King's Landing.
Oh, right, that was going to be the ambush.
Part of the Great Bargain.
Yeah, yeah.
And, that's basically that.
You think they'll make it there?
I think they will make it there, yes, because Cersei needs to see her die.
Yep, you're right. You're right. You got it, man.
But I think Tyeen will poison her.
Yeah. I don't know. So here's a question for you. Who do we do next? Do we go Brienne and Jaime and talk about the Riverlands? And save the worst for last, as it were, with Aaron?
Yeah, let's do it like that. Because okay. Jaime and Brienne... I mean, the impression that you get if you listen to what we are saying, how we are laying it out, these are all giant plots, you know, armies moving and rulers are being toppled and all that kind of stuff. It's very high stakes. Whereas Brienne's and Jaime's storyline right now is on a very personal level. It is very low stakes. Whether or not they live or die really doesn't change any equation right now. This is especially true for Brienne, and Jaime will take a while. If he enters the big picture at all, it will just be because he murders Cersei, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think their drama is on a much more personal level right now. And obviously, the last time we saw them, they were Brienne was taking Jaime prisoner. He didn't know it yet, but that's what she's doing. So she's bringing him to the Brotherhood.
I think they defeat the Brotherhood, I have to assume that's where that's headed. They're not going to die. Neither of them is going to die.
I would think Brienne dies.
At the hands of the Brotherhood?
More or less, yes. You know, like deciding for the sword and dying covering Jaime's escape. See, I mean, how would the two of them defeat the Brotherhood?
I don't know. It depends on how big the Brotherhood is. And, you know, maybe it's one of these deals where, you know, you cut the head off Lady Stoneheart and then what the fuck? What are they, like, the whole, you know, cut the head off the snake?
Yeah, it might be.
I kind of feel like Brienne killing Catelyn has some poetic oomph to it, you know?
Yes.
And I mean,
that's not exclusive.
No, that's true. That's a good point. I was just about to say that. It's entirely possible that they both die. It's a Superman versus Doomsday kind of thing. But I also, and here's another thing that reveals me to be much less the goth nihilist that I make myself out to be. I may have mentioned this also in a previous prediction episode, but I there's got to be some sort of Justice League forming or Avengers forming with the coolest characters, you know, in the future for the final battle against the others. Like, they're not all going to be scattered to the four winds. I think they'll come together and it'll be like a real motley crew of characters who wind up being important in the battle. That's just maybe that's where I want it to go more than where I think it will go or needs to go, but it's definitely where I want it to go. Like, I want to see Bronn and Brienne and fucking, I don't even know who, not Arya Hota, I guess, you know, and John and Danny, like, and like have this cool posse of heroes. Am I a sucker for wanting that? Maybe.
I have no clue, to be honest.
Yeah. But I just, that to me feels like you need the Knights of the Round Table is what I'm basically saying. You need a Kingsguard that's like legit, to use the parlance of the actual story. So I would not be surprised if seven of the best characters lined up behind the three heads of the dragon.
Maybe. I think I'm a little bit too pessimistic for that.
What are the odds that you're more pessimistic than me?
Yeah, there you have it, right? But I would put my chips down, not very forcefully, not very convincingly, but I would put them down if you forced me on Brienne dying and saving Jaime's life, which would also have kind of a poetic ring to it.
Yes, that's true. I just I think Brienne is one of the characters I think will actually make it through the end of the book. So
maybe, yes.
I mean, plural, the whole series is what I'm saying. Yeah. So
I don't have any real stakes in this. You know, it is more like a feeling than any informed thing, because as I've said, this is so low stakes and personal that makes it much harder to think about where this is headed than with the big moments. Yeah. They are a little bit easier to put into an order of appearance.
Yeah. By the way, I think this is more of a feeling than any kind of informed thing is a great tagline for the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. That should be our slogan, our motto, our house words. More of a feeling than any kind of informed thing. That's the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. Yeah.
Maybe it will be the title of this episode. At least.
Just quickly in passing, they're not POV characters, obviously, but your good old friend, the Blackfish, and Walder Frey.
Let's start with Walder Frey, because it will not be Arya murdering him like a super Batman or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think it is almost a necessity that Walder Frey is the last surviving Frey. You know, like his whole family dead and he's sitting in a cold hall as the others descend. If anyone besides Littlefinger deserves to be killed by the others when every political stuff has finally fallen apart, it is Walder Frey.
But so you don't hold to the theory of the second Red Wedding?
Oh yes, but
You don't think Walder will be there or Walder will escape?
No, absolutely not. I think he's on the Twins. The second Red Wedding will definitely happen, but it will happen in the prologue of The Winds of Winter, because we don't have anyone who could right now provide a window into it. So the prologue is really the only way to have it happening, because then you can kill whoever is the POV.
Right.
I'm into that, but not Walder Frey. This will significantly whittle down the number of Freys, but not yet to the full extent. So I would guess Walder Frey survives. I wouldn't even grant him the triumph of a cathartic end, you know, like a triumphant chapter ending when he dies or whatever. It could be just an information. The others are now at this point, and you can infer from that they have taken the Twins, and that Walder Frey most likely didn't survive. But somehow it would be a fitting end for the guy who always had a minority complex.
True.
To not being mentioned on page, right. That would be a little bit meta, but I guess this is how I see this playing out. You know, not in a satisfying way like the show did it, but more in a more poetic total for more in line with what he is,
right.
And not so much the emotional needs of Arya.
As for
but the Blackfish.
What'd you say?
But the Blackfish.
I was gonna say your pal, the Blackfish.
Yeah, my best friend. I mean, my paragon of virtue.
Right.
I have no clue what happens to him, and basically, I don't give a fuck. I think he will be a prime mover and shaker behind a second Red Wedding, and from there on. He will fight, he will raid, and he will do stuff, and it may be important or it may be not, and at some point he will die or he will not, but whatever, man.
What about when he meets his insane zombie niece?
If.
You don't think they'll meet?
How does he
participate in the second Red Wedding and hook up with the Brotherhood without getting wind of who's leading the Brotherhood? Like, if wouldn't they tell, like, wouldn't they be like, look, man, your sister's alive? That's the first fucking thing I'd say to him.
Yeah, but they are always pretty pretty forthright with the fact that they don't consider this to be Catelyn Tully. They are always talking about Lady Stoneheart, and they are saying that she's not the same and much changed and whatever. So maybe they don't.
I suppose you're right.
But I have no clue. The thing about the Blackfish really is, I don't care.
So that leaves us with, unless there was anything else, with Aaron and who we know somewhat what's going on with him because we saw his preview chapter. Things are going extremely poorly. He's being starved and tortured and drugged, I think. And just generally tormented by his increasingly insane Cthulhu-worshipping pirate sorcerer brother, who just gets cooler and cooler every time you see him. It's like, oh, by the way, like, I wouldn't be surprised, you know, like, he's got Valyrian steel armor head to toe. In nightmares, he appears that he has, like, tentacles growing out of his face. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if the next time you see him, he's like, oh, I've brought machine guns because I found a dimensional porthole. Like, it's just, there's no telling where this asshole's headed, but no place good. So
he has a Valyrian steel armor.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
It's pretty cool. Now, I don't know why this never occurred to me before. Maybe it has, and I've just been writing and thinking about these books so much for so long that I forgot. But theoretically, Euron will want to sack Old Town, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, in Old Town, there's Samwell.
Yes.
Or Will of it, yeah. And with Samwell is a certain Horn.
Yes.
So, I know I'm not as into the Euron is the Antichrist theory, as some. But I mean, that's just sitting right there.
Yes.
He's got to fucking climb the high tower and blow the horn, and that's how the wall falls, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I'm totally behind this theory. So I'm one of the others you just mentioned.
Okay.
Because this is the brainchild, obviously, of poor Quentin, and we had him here on the show, and he's a very insightful guy, and he made a string of arguments about what is going to happen. He has a very detailed plan, which has to be wrong somewhere, I guess, or else he's a really fucking genius. But. The general contours seem pretty clear. I mean, when our sample chapter ends with Aaron being chained to the prow of the Silence, they are going to do a giant ritual/sea battle. I'm not sure which part will take priority, but I would come down on the ritual, which will spell the end of the Red Wine Fleet. So there is nothing left in the way that can defend Old Town. And Old Town seems to be a place where that exerts a certain gravitational pull. You know, it starts in A Feast for Crows, and you can hear echoes of it in A Dance with Dragons. But there is stuff going on there. And this will definitely happen. I mean, I can see Euron going in there, somehow acquiring the horn, or maybe even Samwell blowing it to warn the people, you know, the horn that wakes the sleepers. And he's like, oh my god, let's sound the alarm, dude, and he brings the wall down with it or something.
Oh, man.
But I think it will be Euron in a more conscious act. The wall shouldn't fall by accident, you know?
Yes, I agree with you.
That seems just a little bit too much.
Yep.
Euron talks about, when he speaks to Aeron in the Feast for Crows chapters, he says that you can only know whether you can fly when you find a tall tower and leap from it.
Ooh,
and
boy. Hello.
Tall. High yep. tower, you know. So this all fits together very neatly. So I am on board with the idea that Euron will sack Old Town, will get his hands on several strong magic artifacts. He already has a collection, so I don't know, getting some combos out of it doesn't seem out of place. He will sound the Horn of Joramon and bring down the wall, because he envisions himself as a demigod who strikes an alliance with the others, or something like the Saruman of the story, basically.
Yeah.
And, of course, Victarion is the poor fool who gives him his dragon, which he will also get. And then he can take his dragon and go on from there.
I just don't think he's getting the dragon.
I definitely do.
I don't... How? I've never understood how. How does that happen?
Magic. Man, magic, you have to believe.
No, I know. Should I clap my hands like it's Tinkerbell and I'm trying to...
Hey, every time you don't believe, Euron will get a dragon somewhere.
One thing I will say about Euron in all seriousness is I don't think Euron will experience a moment of like, my God, what have I done? The way Littlefinger will... Littlefinger feels bad. Like I think Euron's gonna die laughing.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Like no matter what happens, I think he's just gonna have a grand old time.
That's or simply surprised. How can someone reject him? You know how couldn't this play out?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. Like I think I don't think he'll have any kind of moment of being abashed or surprised or disappointed.
I think he's just gonna.
If you've seen the film version of Richard III that takes place in a sort of alternate history fascist 1930s Britain with Ian McKellen, like when he dies, he's like literally falling into hell and laughing the whole time. And I feel like that's spoiler alert for people who haven't read this 500-year-old play. Richard III dies, but you know. He's just a crazy, you know, terrible man. So I kind of feel like he'll enjoy whatever happens to him.
Yeah, he will definitely die. Yeah. I mean, Euron's role, poor Quentin always says he's basically Saruman. you know, like Saruman, hijacking the story, becoming the villain of the story, while in reality the real villain is someone else, which is Sauron in The Lord of the Rings and the others in The Song of Ice and Fire. But the heroes need to dispatch Saruman or Euron before they can go to the real enemy. And how I imagine this playing out, because it just fits so neatly, is that Euron will basically open a southern front. So he destroys Old Town and forces everyone in there to go somewhere else. So this means Samwell and most likely the Sphinx and maybe some other people they pick up on the way. And then they go to Highgarden. And I think Highgarden for several reasons. One, like Castle Rock, it has been teased all over the place. And second, George has more or less confirmed that it has to play a role and that Willis Tyrell has to play a role when he said it was a mistake of the show to write him out. So the idea that poor Quentin has, and which I'm ripping off here, is that they will all go to Highgarden, organize the defense against Euron and his Cthulhu army, whatever. And Euron, when he gets his dragon, which he totally will try to make an alliance with Daenerys. And she will be tempted and in the end turn him down and simply roast him, which fits nicely in what you think about dying either laughing or having no time being surprised. You know, like stretching out his hand, do you accept? And she's like, Dracarys, burn. And then this is over.
I guess I just don't see him getting the dragon. I really don't.
Okay, then even if he doesn't get a dragon, this should be the general gist of it.
Yeah.
And you just killed a dragon, baby.
I think...
You should clap your hands.
I killed a dragon, baby?
Yes, because you said he won't get a dragon. Clap your hands. Bring it back.
Oh, right. Come back.
Oh, man. That was close.
Yeah. Phew. That was a tough one. So is there anything left? Have we gone through this whole godforsaken book?
I think we have, yes. So now George only needs to write it.
Hey, no problem. Oh, we did all the heavy lifting for him.
Yes, absolutely. You should thank us. But really, I hope everyone has enjoyed this tour so far. And of course, here comes the obvious begging and request. If you want to keep this stuff coming, support us on Patreon. This is really a help from all of you guys. And we need every penny we can get to keep the show rolling. So if you have a dime to spare... Yeah. Throw it in our direction.
Yep, it's patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. There's also a PayPal link at the top of boiledleather.com. But the Patreon is a great way to just, you know, kick in a couple dollars every month and keep the lights on for us. Keep our kids in I don't know. Our kids aren't wearing diapers anymore. Mine aren't. So
mine are.
Well, there we go. Keep Stefan's
kids. Little Liana is still in diapers.
Keep Stefan's kids in diapers and keep my kids off the streets. There you go.
That was melodramatic.
Yeah, like we're Dickensian urchins. Like, alms for the poor. So, yeah, thank you very much for listening. This was a lot of fun. And I guess we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.